Welcome to the podcast. We're talking cybersecurity. Today, we've got Ivan Fonseca. Here he is. Here's his LinkedIn. So Ivan just started at Google as an incident response consultant. Whenever we first started chatting, he was at ThreatLocker. And ThreatLocker is a advanced EDR and MDR tool. But he was a cybersecurity engineer and researcher there. I discovered him originally on YouTube, where he was in a interview talking about bash bunnies for ThreatLocker, and we'll talk about bash bunnies. But I saw something in this guy. He's going places. I just know it. So I want to have him on the podcast. Can't wait to see where his career goes. And here we go. All right. Welcome to the podcast, Ivan. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm excited to have you on. Couple warm-up questions here for you. Normally ask about your favorite Star Wars movie, but now I'm just kind of opened it up to any movie. So what's your favorite movie? What's your favorite band?
It's funny that you tell me, because Star Wars is literally my favorite franchise. So I'll keep it in the Star Wars focus space. My favorite movie is Return of the Jedi.
Oh, perfect.
It's just a classic.
Yeah, classic. Yeah, I love that one too. That version of Luke is one of the best ones. And I hate kind of how they turn Luke into like a pacifist, you know, like he's almost, all his special sauce is gone. He's given up. Yep. And you can tell in the interviews with Mark Hamill, you know, even though he likes hanging out with Joe Biden, I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt, right? I still like the guy. But yeah, even he was upset about what they did to the character. Hopefully one day we'll see his character in a different light, where you get his midlife and they'll actually kind of show him being more of a hero. But we'll see. All right, what's your favorite band? What kind of music you listening to?
Band. I listen to a lot of music. I'll take it back to my childhood. My favorite band when I was coming up as a kid was Imagine Dragons. I was all about Imagine Dragons as a little kid. In terms of favorite band, I don't really have one nowadays. I just listen to everything.
Yeah, I just pretty much tell, hey, Morgan Wallen radio.
Morgan Wallen's got some good music.
Yeah, good golf cart music. So I discovered you through a YouTube video. And I can't remember who was hosting it, but it was about bash bunnies. And for those who don't know, a bash bunny looks like a USB drive, but it's bigger. It's got embedded software on there, more features for hacking and stealing data. And you were going through a, you know, demo about that. And, you know, I was listening to you, and then I pulled up your LinkedIn. I was like, wow, this guy, you know, he's early in career, but you know, he's smart. He's confident. He speaks very well. This kid's going places. So, you know, and then I saw your post about the RSA conference. I mean, that picture of you in the dark arts village, and said you were like teaching live hacking sessions. And I was like, yeah, that looks epic, because the lighting was like crazy looking. Yeah, I'm excited to have you on, man. And I look forward to kind of seeing where your career goes from here. But for those who are just discovering you today, can you tell us a little bit about your story and, you know, how you landed in cyber?
Yeah. So we can take you back all the way back. I'll try to summarize it, of course, to keep it short. I've loved doing this ever since I was, say, maybe 13, 14, tinkering around with devices, computers. I built my first computer at 13, 14. One of my father's friends, his son was a Linux admin at the time. We were just visiting their house. He was like, yeah, man, I just started doing this thing. And then he was showing me the different things they were working on. For example, he just had a terminal up, but at that point I was impressed. I was like, you know, you're using the terminal, you're a hacker. He's like, no, I'm not a hacker. But then he explained to me a little bit about the Linux operating system. He gave me a book. And yeah, from there, my creativity and my inspiration just flourished. And I kept discovering new things and learning as much as I can. I would just read books as a hobby or for fun. And I would just hack for fun back in my PlayStation days on the PlayStation 4 and PlayStation 3. I can't exactly say what I was doing, but
yeah, yeah. Now I want to know. Now we have to know. You know, if you play PS3 now, like the graphics are still arguably pretty good compared to the graphics now. It's crazy. But yeah, okay. Tell us what you were doing.
I don't know if I can go exactly into that.
All right.
I'd rather not say.
All right. No worries. So you learned Linux. So that was your original, like, learning Linux scripting, Linux kernel. How did it progress from there?
I just installed like Debian, Ubuntu on machines. And then I got into Kali. And that's when I was like, okay, this looks cool. This is meant for hacking. At the beginning, obviously, I had no idea what I was doing. That's what I tell beginners. You have no idea what you're doing at the beginning, but trust me, it all just like a eureka moment, and it all just comes in and works, and you can start associating things. So yeah, so I installed Kali on the machine, and then I just started playing around with like John the Ripper, Hydra, and Map. Didn't really know exactly what they did, but since I had read about it previously, I could start, you know, joining things together, and that's when everything started clicking. I said, okay, this 2-1 map is for network scanning. This is exactly the ports I've been, you know, reading about, port 22. This is what it looks like in an Nmap scan. And then from that point on, I started, like I said, joining those dots together, learning more and more, just reading as much as I can, YouTube, and obviously hacking myself at my house, my own devices. I learned that way. I just slowly but surely, it took me a couple years, but obviously now me being older, it's that those many years of indirect but fun, you know, experience just got me to where I am today.
Very cool. I follow another YouTube channel called Unsupervised Learning. I really love it. It's guy Daniel Meisler. He actually just agreed to be on the podcast. Amazing. But he was saying how in the future AI is going to be able to identify talented people based on all the things they've ever posted on social media, and basically be able to pick out folks who have, you know, may not have a 4-year college degree, but if they've got like content ever since they were 15 about their journey through discovering Linux and, you know, hacking this, hacking that, and like they'll be able to just pick out the folks who are so eager to learn that they would have done it anyway. And even without, you know, forcing them to do any training, they're just like attracted to it. They're interested in it and they went for it. So yeah, man, cool. I think, you know, the AI probably would have discovered you. But you recently made a career change. So when we first connected, you're still with ThreatLocker, but you landed at Google recently. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, that must feel incredible. I mean, Google, right? They're highly sought after employer. Everybody, you know, would love to work there. That's got to feel incredible. So I hope you accomplish many things there. But I'm a tech recruiter, right? So I'm always interested in how the hiring process went, right? What was the journey like? You may not be able to go into every little thing, but, and I don't work with Google, so I have no idea, but, you know, I am interested in learning about the hiring process. So how did that opportunity find you, and what was that process like?
Yeah, so I got an email in my inbox saying that they wanted to, you know, just have a conversation. Initially, that first email, I didn't see it. I don't know why. So 12 days elapsed, and then I checked my inbox again. I have a second email, and I was just in my house at that time, and I'm like, this email has been in my inbox this whole time. I hadn't been seeing it. And then I see, hey, Ivan, are you still looking forward to talking to us? Instantly, you know, I just rush replied, yeah, let's do it whenever you guys have time. So I started the interview process, and honestly, it was great. Obviously, like you said, I can't talk a lot about it, but right. I think Google is about the coolest company I've ever interviewed for. And just the process was quick. It was great, the people I got to meet. So even if I didn't get hired by Google, I still think the process was great. I think it was a great experience.
Huh, that's interesting, because most big enterprises struggle with this lengthy process that's very painful with 5, 6, 7, 8 steps. So, yeah, I'm surprised to hear that. So good. I mean, that means they're doing a good job. So I wonder, you presented at RSA. I wonder if there was like scouts there, you know, that might have discovered you at RSA. I mean, like, yo, we got to hire this kid.
I met a couple people from the Google team. But I was already interviewing beforehand.
Okay.
The interview process took, it didn't go all in a week. It was, I would say, like spanned about 3 weeks. But I'm definitely sure that, and then like you said, using AI, finding candidates through just posts on social media sites, that's a huge thing. I think one of the things that caught their eye, the sorcerers, I would say, is just me being at RSA. I'd let them know how I'm like, hey, I'm speaking at RSA. And just seeing my LinkedIn, my GitHub, that's another thing. One of my mentors, and maybe we'll talk a little bit more about mentors later, but one of my mentors made it very clear that, hey, you need to have a GitHub page. You need to show the world what you're capable of doing. And GitHub is great because you have a repository and people can look at your code, look at the stuff you've been working on, how you've been building it, and the way that you code. And I think those things were pointed out by them, by the sorcerers, which was, you know, looking at my GitHub and seeing the projects. And also I'm almost certain they were impressed by the fact that I was speaking at RSA, that I was just involved. And a lot of the people that are coming into the industry, I tell them, hey, use social media. Talk about what you're doing. If you don't present yourself, nobody's going to present you for them. So you have to voice here. You have to get your voice out there. You got to show people what you're doing. And that's very important.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. And that's part of the reason for this podcast. And by coming on here and being a guest, right? This is an opportunity for you as well. So yeah, man, definitely. If you're early in career and trying to create a name for yourself, you know, you got to put yourself out there. You got to use your voice because no one is coming to save you, right? You have to do it yourself. And you always have to remember as well that even if 99% of every person on earth hated your guts, that would still leave about 70 million people that loved everything you did. So just remember that, right? Think about the one person that you could help and try to add value. Kudos to you for learning that early in your career, right? Most people don't discover that until later in life, right? I was well in my 30s before I got serious about anything. Otherwise, I was working basically just for drinking money and trying to chase girls. All the wrong things I was focused on. So yeah, you seem to have learned quickly. So kudos to you. Hey, about continuing on with the interview process, did you have to do any live coding interviews for Google?
No, I didn't. I'm not certain, but I'm sure that's more for the software engineer route.
Okay, I didn't know if they made you do any live scripting or automate this or something like that. Did you have a take-home project, a take-home test?
Well, actually, I'm not sure if I can talk about that one.
Okay. Well, so we'll assume you did. I mean, it's either yes or no. I'm just wondering if they're doing that or if that, because a lot of companies do that. And I recently submitted a candidate for a different job, and it was a full stack JavaScript developer job. And the coding project, I was looking at it. I mean, it didn't seem like it was going to take that long. It's basically create an API and link it in with React. And the person has ghosted, completely ghosted. I guess it scared them away. And it does. It scares people away. But I get why companies do it. They just want to see an example of what are you capable of here? Can you actually write code? I guess it is part of the screening process. And every time it's doing its job, whether you try it or not. So your new role, right? It's incident response consultant, and it's in the Google Cloud group, but it's within a subcategory, the Mandiant group, which is like Google's cybersecurity squad for their cloud product, right?
Yeah. So Mandiant is basically the security for Google Cloud. But since I'm doing consultant, obviously we work with different customers and different amount of people, different products. But yeah, we are a subsidiary of the Google Cloud, and it's the Mandiant team. Yeah.
Okay. So you get to be client facing in this role, right? Google customers, you're the face of Google. So man, they picked a good one. All right. Kudos to you, man. That's a good role for you. If I was a big company and trying to figure out what's going on in my cybersecurity, especially if I was using Google Workspaces opposed to Microsoft or whatnot, and if they assigned me to you, I'd be like, oh, all right, this is all right, cool. They've got some solid people over there. So good eye, Google. You mentioned mentors. So do you want to chat about that? Like some of the folks that you were good mentors for you? You want to give them a shout out?
Definitely. So one of my main mentors is Luis Capella. He's a manager now, data science manager at Disney. It's kind of ironic because he does data science. Before I got into cybersecurity, I was thinking about doing data science. I was going for internship at Disney, but I just changed perspectives just due to the fact that, you know, I said I love cyber. I love what they do in cybersecurity, and that's just my passion. Although I learned so much about data science, and he taught me skills that I could apply that were data science skills, but skills that I could apply outside into other, you know, tech industries, such as cybersecurity. Like I said, he was the one that taught me build your GitHub repository, build that portfolio, because that's something that you can show off. And that's something that is a clear indicator that you know what you're doing. You know how to code, you know how to build tools. And he was a huge prospect of solving, you know, big problems or any problem that people are having on a day-to-day basis. So from that point on, I did a data science project. I didn't enjoy it as much. And that's when I figured out I probably like cybersecurity more. And that's when I started building, you know, other tools. Now I'm building a tool called AutoMap, and it's a Python tool. So data science, I think they use a language called R, but also they're very big on Python. So that's where I started. I learned Python. I learned it really well. And then I started just doing small projects, and small projects became bigger projects and more complex problems. And like I said, now I'm working on a tool called AutoMap. It basically just automates nmap scans for usually like CTFs or capture the flags, like hack the box, try hack me. And it's just a tool for me and for others that just want, you know, fast enumeration and just easy, just a nice formatted data back from those scans. So that's one of the tools that I'm working on now. And then my very first mentor that I spoke about was the one that actually introduced me to Linux. His name is Roberto Chaud, and he is an amazing guy. He's the one that basically sparked that interest and said, hey, that hobby that you have, you can make it a career. And then another one of my mentors is Mike Burgess, and he worked at Google for quite some time. He's a sales engineer. And I just you know, shadowed him and saw under his wing another project that he was working on the side. And he just taught me ways. And actually, he helped me get my Google Cloud Architect certification. He just, you know, taught me the ropes in Google Cloud. And with his help, I was able to pass that exam and get that certification and learn more about cloud. So he's the mentor that got me into the cloud. And then Roberto was the one that got me into Linux and just, you know, systems administration and engineering. And then Luis Capella, he pushed me more into that data science, developmental, and just reaching out to other people and making your name known.
Nice, nice. Yeah, at first when I glanced at your profile, I saw you had two certifications. But then if you look down, there's actually eight there. You got AWS and GCP,
yeah,
Cloud Architect. So, oh, and Azure. All right, you got all of them.
Yeah.
Dang, man. You're highly decorated and early in career, too. You've been busy, my man. Hey, AutoMap, that sounds interesting. Is this an open source project that anyone can use?
Yeah, it's open source. It's very early in the developmental cycle. I just finished basically the GUI, the very beginning of it, just the banner. And right now what it does is just a port scan, but it shows the port scan in a very organized way. And then I also have a service scan, but I'm parsing the data. So when I parse data, I just try to grab a big chunk of data that sometimes is unintelligible, and then just make it into something that's digestible and easy to see. So right now I'm working on the service enumeration section, which is just, you know, grabbing a web server, figuring out what service is running on it, what port is running on it, and what version of that service is on it. So I'm working on parsing that data. And then from that point on, I have 100 other ideas for the project, but slowly but surely we'll get to where I want to be.
Interesting. Okay. And when you say nmap scans, for folks who don't know, and I know, of course, I know all this, but what do you mean by nmap scans? Is that has something to do with the packet coming through the firewall or something like that?
It does, yes. So it's a network scan, and by sending packets, it can basically figure out information from the server. So nmap has created a tool that allows you to figure out, you know, the time to live of a server. And like I've mentioned before, sometimes the time to live can let us know something is a Windows device or a Linux device. So it also has that OS detection. It has simple scripting detection. So for example, it has pre-made scripts that can let you know if you have an Apache server that could be vulnerable, or an Nginx server that could be vulnerable, or an SSH server that can be vulnerable. So it helps you find versions of services that are on ports. It does port scanning. And then it lets you know, hey, is this vulnerable or is it not vulnerable? Or at least it gives you enough information for you to do further research and figure out something is vulnerable or not.
Very cool. And if you're trying to win a capture the flag at a hackathon event, like, this is a tool that would be a big advantage for you to use, right?
This is pivotal. Yeah, I've heard most people use Nmap. Some people use Rust Scan, but most widely use Nmap. A lot of people have automation tools like AutoMap that help you get even faster. So you send it away, you put an IP address, and it goes and does its thing and gives you information back.
Okay. All right. So it's built on top of Nmap, basically.
Correct.
Okay. Interesting. I do want to get into the tools like Tech Talk with you, because I feel like you're going to have some really unique opinions about there's a million cybersecurity tools out there. Can you kind of go into some of your favorites, which tools you feel like are top tier?
We're talking about hardware tools or software?
Ooh, good question. Let's start with software and we'll do hardware later.
So software, going back to the different vendors, I can basically generalize it for you because I don't want to bring it down to one vendor. There's a lot of vendors, but things that you might need. Can we give an example? Like starting an enterprise, right? Somebody was to start a company tomorrow and they're like, hey, Ivan, what do I need to start? Is that where we want to go with?
Right. So let's say I'm running a startup and I have 30 employees and I'm trying to just get the basic security posture going. What are like the top tools that I want to definitely use? And then if I had a lot of cash to invest, because you, sky's the limit. If you got unlimited money, then you can just keep throwing money at cybersecurity. It's exactly. A money pit. It exactly. is a massive money pit. But what are like the core items that you would not want to live without?
So one of the first things is just employee awareness. I'm going to directly say vendor here, Know Before, that's a must. I mean, I think Know Before helps you get, and don't quote me on this because I'm not GRC. I think it helps you get your SOC 2 compliance with employee training. So that's one of the most important things. I think your employees just need to be aware of what's happening and what are the potential attack vectors and how to identify them. The next one is email security. You definitely want an email security filter or some type of email security software that allows you to filter out phishing emails, possibly use some type of AI detection to find phishing emails or any type of, you know, attempt to compromise through spear phishing or just phishing campaigns against any of your employees. The next thing is, and this comes a lot from my prior experience, obviously, is protecting endpoints. Let's protect those servers. Let's protect those laptops, those IoT devices, especially, you know, those employee-used laptops. Those are extremely important assets. So we want to use some type of endpoint security platform. Could be ThreatLocker, could be CrowdStrike, could be your different type of vendors out there. In that case, obviously, ThreatLocker being the endpoint protection platform. But they have a theory that's amazing, and it's just deny things by default. So I think having a vendor that allows you to block things by default helps you because everything gets blocked. You know, nothing bad can get into your machine. But then also having an EDR system in the back end, obviously they have their EDR, but pairing that up with a second EDR for just an extra layer of protection, somebody like a CrowdStrike or a Huntress or SentinelOne would be great. Obviously, you know, CrowdStrike being one of the top ones from the, I believe the G2 list said they were one of the top EDRs, and their threat detection rules are just, you know, really good around the clock. But I think just securing the endpoint through an EDR solution, a solution that also blocks things by default, and email security are the main points for hackers. So if you can lock those things down, it'll be extremely important.
Email security, is that something built into Google Workspace or Microsoft Office, or is that are you talking about something like Memecast?
So email security, obviously these solutions are already on there by default. So if there's a phishing email and it's blatantly obvious, it'll catch it. But I'm talking about a second layer. Actually, I was in an event at RSA a couple weeks ago, and also Abnormal. So they're doing some email filtering. They use email filtering through AI to detect if something is malicious or not malicious, or the email has malicious intent. You already have that basic level of security with your normal email clients, but you want to add a second layer of security with one of these vendors to just make sure you filter out all that white noise or any type of malicious emails that are being sent to your employees.
Nice. I was thinking like the analogy, right? The typical EDR tool is like a mall cop, right? They can only observe and report. They don't stop anything from happening. They don't prevent the hacking or the data theft. You know, they can detect an issue, but all they can do is blow the whistle and, you know, point, and then someone else has to come in and fix it. But I guess that was one of the benefits from some of the more modern EDR tools, is that they do have the capability of stopping things. You probably have some bias towards ThreatLocker because you did spend time there and you're probably involved in some of the new features and all that stuff. But I guess, who do you feel like are the top contenders in that space?
In the EDR space, I'd definitely say ThreatLocker is up there, of course. I'd say also CrowdStrike is up there. I mean, obviously Palo Alto is up there, although they're a little bit older, but they were the pioneers in this. I mean, everybody was just a copy of Palo Alto, I like to say, because they were one of the first ones and industry leaders in doing this. Also, obviously, so you have your SentinelOne and Huntress, but I specifically think, you know, CrowdStrike is one of the leaders. ThreatLocker is doing things differently. Palo Alto is just great, just in the repertoire of capabilities and detection that they have is just immense. And obviously, as I work more and more with these tools, I'll be able to learn them better and have a more, I try to say, unbiased. Since I am moving into consulting now, I do want to have an unbiased look at everything and say, right, you know, maybe this is better. And I thought it was worse before, but after using it, I think this is better. And we can recommend it to clients, of course. And my point of view now is I have to learn all the tools and have an unbiased approach to them so I can just help my customers. And that's my goal in life now.
Very cool. Yeah, you get to be kind of a broker for, and you may find that there are, you know, if it's a certain industry or a certain size company, you could recommend one solution versus another just based on the use case and where one tool shines versus another. So it'll be, man, if you can get to learn, like if you can plot out this diagram, you know, of strengths and weaknesses of all these tools and figure out which ones that you'd recommend, you'll become a highly sought after resource, man. Let us know when you create that visual document. I want to see it. Well, where do you get your general threat intel and like vulnerability indicators from? What are your main sources of information?
So back when I was doing most of the threat detection for ThreatLocker, I'd get most of my threat intelligence from different sources. Obviously, you have Bleeping Computer. You want to stay up to date. That's just a public resource for everybody. And obviously, I still do this. Everything that I did at ThreatLocker, I still do on a daily basis. And I still get my threat intelligence from there. So Bleeping Computer, the Hacker News, not as much, but Bleeping Computer more. But then getting more into the nitty-gritty stuff, VX Underground. You can pull some malware samples off of VX Underground. But that's more, you know, where you have to go in, download the sample, do your own testing, and just do dynamic or heuristic analysis on the binary and just see how it, you know, reacts in an environment. Another thing is Lolbass. It's something that not a lot of people are focusing on. That's a living off the land binary project. It's an open source project. And basically you can track living off the land binaries that are native to a Windows environment. And sometimes it'll give you even detections. The other thing is following a basically threat detection framework, kind of like Sigma or Yara. Yara being more for the static analysis or just, you know, finding strings within binaries that could be malicious. That goes more into signature detection. So Yara helps a lot with signature detection. And then obviously Sigma helps more with basically heuristic or behavioral detection. So following those two frameworks, and obviously there, it's an open source project, so people are constantly funneling it in with data and new rules per se, and you can go through those and just see what's going on in the threat landscape. Another one is the MITRE project, and people, I don't know why, some people discredit it, some people really like it. I really like it. I think they're doing really well. Obviously, they won't be able to cover everything under the sun. I mean, there's just so many new TTPs that are being developed every single day by malicious actors and APTs. But the MITRE framework for a beginner is an extremely essential tool. So it's hard to understand at the beginning because you have so many different, you know, moving parts. But once you start to break it down and understand the different techniques and the detections behind them, you kind of have a clear view of what's currently happening in the wild. I'm thinking about another one that just came to, oh, the CISA reports for APTs. I wrote an article on Bolt Typhoon. They're a Chinese nation state actor that was basically tracked down by CISA. And they have a full report on known indicators of compromise or behavior that is just, you know, used by this organization. Another blog that I use, and I'm just going to keep, you know, I'm just going to shoot them out for you guys. Hades.io. They're huge. Like they, the way that, and I don't know anybody from Hades.io, but if you're hearing me, you're doing a great job because they're making these reports that are just visually appealing and they are digestible and understandable by those that are in the cybersecurity industry, even if you're more of a beginner. They break things down with even images. So when I was learning persistence, the art of persistence, I learned most of it off of their blog article. And obviously once you learn a couple of things, you realize how much, how little you know. So then you keep going into it and you go into this rabbit hole. But they started me off with the art of Windows persistence and Linux persistence. And those articles are great. They're focused more on red teaming. So if you're looking for, you know, those red teaming tactics, then Hades.io is, you know, the source to find it. And the reason I say red teaming is because if you want to learn how to stop something, I'm a big, you know, big advocate of learning how to break into it. So if you can hack it, you can probably most likely stop the hack. So if you learn how to red team, then you'll probably learn how to blue team, given the right time and the right tools. So Hades.io will teach you how to break into things and how adversaries are using exploits in the wild.
Yeah, I've heard of Bleeping Computer, the Hacker News, and CISA. All those other ones, those are brand new to me. Living off the land. I had never heard that even mentioned before until I watched your most recent podcast. Just for folks who don't understand what living off the land is, like, can you explain it like you're talking to your grandma?
Yeah. So if I was talking to my grandma, I would tell her that these are applications that are just already installed on your laptop when you get it. So you buy your laptop from Best Buy, Walmart, Amazon, wherever it may be, pop in front of you. Windows is installed and you get that first screen, that boot up screen, and you're able to access, you know, your different applications, go to the web. These are applications that are already living inside of your machine. You didn't do anything. You didn't have to install them. They come with the operating system. But these tools have capabilities, or I guess you can say powers, that can be leveraged by hackers to do bad things on your machine, like steal your data or get access to administrative privileges. Or be able to maintain a presence on your machine or stay on your machine and spy on you. So these are just some of the things that hackers can do with binaries or applications that are already on your machine that you didn't have to do anything about. And most people aren't even aware of these because they don't even use them. These are more, many of the Lolbass binaries or the Lolbins are binaries that administrators use. We don't even use. Like how many times has somebody that, you know, isn't an admin or somebody that isn't in tech use a tool like certutil.exe? It's not used. So those tools are usually terminal tools that are accessible through CMD or PowerShell that just a normal user, standard user won't use. But these are tools that can be leveraged by hackers to do really bad things on your device.
So you can go to Lolbass and run on your own personal machine, look at the programs that run at startup. And it's a normally a gigantic list, right? It's gotten bigger and bigger over the years. Like you used to run it and there's like maybe 15, 20, you know, and then it was 30, then it was 50. Now it's like 200, you know, because the processors can handle all these multi-streaming, quad-core, octa-core type things. So like now they're just loading your computer up with so many apps that are watching everything you're doing. Some of them are, you know, malicious. Some of them are just allowed by Dell, you know, every time, like they made big money off of allowing these apps to watch everything you're doing, and they're selling your data, and people don't even realize like all these. So you can go on Lolbass, and when you get a new machine, check all the apps running on startup, just copy and paste the names into Lolbass and find out which ones are the ones you should get rid of, basically. Yeah.
And some of these aren't even on startup. Some of these are just dormant on your machine. They live in the file system somewhere. They don't even run on startup, so you don't even know they exist. They're somewhere in System 32, right? And they're deep into System 32, and you have no idea these binaries even live in your machine. They're just dormant. But if you open up Terminal and you execute the binary or call it, it'll give you a whole command line of tools. And then obviously between those command line tools or those capabilities that the tool already has or the binary has, these hackers were able to create exploits for the machine or ways of getting data out or spying on you.
That's crazy. The average person will never find that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, what are normal people supposed to do? I mean, they're not going to buy a cybersecurity managed service. You know, it's like a normal antivirus software isn't really going to do anything about that. So if you're trying to create cybersecurity awareness and, you know, there's these living off the land binaries that could be on your machine right now and nothing you could do about it. Like, what are you supposed to do about it?
So, yeah, like I said, again, it's employee awareness and user awareness. So especially at Google, one of our missions is to, you know, just share knowledge with people and help people out. Our whole goal is, you know, share knowledge, help people. That's why Google was created. That's why the search engine was created. So the world can have access to data easier and faster. It's like the Library of Alexandria on the internet, right? So that's Google's goal. And I guess my goal as well is to help people not get hacked. So once again, is if you're just a normal user, and it kind of sucks that that's the world that we live in, but all of us now just need user awareness training where we need to learn to identify what a phishing email looks like, what it doesn't. And obviously, these built-in mail software tools, they'll flag something if it's known bad. They'll flag something, but you need that little extra step of education just to know not to click things. So obviously, if we're looking more towards our grandma or grandpa, the younger, the youth, it's kind of our job to help them and say, hey, this is, if something like this comes up, if somebody weird calls you, ask you for your social security, don't give it to them. Just, you know, call me and ask me. Don't just go straight giving out information.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the Ivan in my family, right? and that's pretty, that's not good either, because I'm still kind of I'm an amateur, right? I'm not a hacker at all. I know enough, you know, to know all the stuff I don't know. But yeah, as far as like personal data privacy, I've covered a lot about passwords and how to protect your passwords and how often, but you know, you have to be on social media, but at the same time, all the social media accounts are watching you. And you know, there's a debate right now about TikTok. Are you on TikTok at all? Do you use that?
No.
Would you recommend everyone delete TikTok right now?
I cannot say that.
Okay. I don't know if you had an opinion on it or not. I feel like, you know, we're getting mad at TikTok for doing whatever with our data, but then the American companies are doing the same thing. It's like, okay.
Whatever. I tend to stay off of social media other than LinkedIn just because obviously it's kind of, I need to build my brand, but other than that, I just like to, you know, talk with other people in the tech space. But other than that, I don't really use much social media at all.
I hear you. Well, yeah, YouTube, LinkedIn, maybe Facebook. So your mom can see what you're doing.
Exactly.
So AI, let's talk about AI for just a second. What are we going to do when AI takes all the jobs?
So it's a bit of a sensitive topic because some people really think, and I mean, it's sometimes AI has taken already some people's jobs, and it's really sad. But I think the world is shifting and evolving in a way that sometimes we don't understand. And what I mean by that is, if tech is evolving, then we need to evolve as a human race as well. So we just need to acquire more knowledge and learn skills that just are irreplaceable. And the reason I say this is because as much as we trust AI, you can't trust this, trust it as much as a human, because, you know, a human, you can go back to it and you can, you know, you can file a lawsuit if something goes bad. But how do you file a lawsuit against AI? You have to sue the company itself, wouldn't you? So it's a huge problem. But I think AI will not take every single job in the U.S. Honestly, I don't think it'll take a lot of it. I'm not, you know, the person to talk to for the statistics behind how many jobs AI will eliminate in the past, you know, in the next 5 years, next 10 years. I'm not exactly sure of that. But what I do know is, if anything, I've seen AI change the landscape in where it's taking more of the, and I don't mean to offend anybody, more of the monotonous tasks. In the terms of art, I understand that. I've heard from some artists that, you know, this new AI renaissance where it's just creating art and different music. I think that's kind of sad, because the music and the art that's coming from humans is nice. It's, you can tell it's from a secure source. It's the inspiration, the creativity of a person. So I believe, you know, that's kind of sad that it's taking some creators' jobs. But obviously in the other tasks, it's taking more of the monotonous roles and not exactly the complex work. I do not trust AI creating my, per se, a startup for me, like a startup where I have a software-based company where I'm selling a piece of software that needs to be intrinsically secure or connects people together. I don't trust AI coding that for me. I trust a developer that I have, you know, that I can schedule a meeting with and have a one-on-one with, and just, you know, have them express themselves through the project and explain to me the project and how they built it. It's just a layer of trust that you can't break. It's that human-to-human interaction that AI just can't replace.
Yeah, I've heard that it is a tool that can be leveraged for folks who are very experienced and know how to do whatever they're trying to accomplish manually, because they have the knowledge to correct it whenever they know that the AI has fed it something wrong, or, wait a minute, you know, something doesn't look right. But if you're trying to use AI to learn something new, and you don't know whether what it's telling you is right or wrong, because it's going to tell you something, it's just trying to make you happy, the younger folks can easily be fooled because they haven't had this experience where they've had to do all this work manually. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
I'm worried about what it's going to do to the recruiting game, because if Scarlett Johansson called me up and, you know, if they're trying to do a phone screen with me, I'm not going to be upset about having a phone interview with a very polite and nice person that is also giving me compliments. I did a demo. There's a tool out there called Vitan.ai, and I'm going to have them on the podcast as well to chat about their technology, because it's pretty cool. And, you know, when you Google it, there's like 8 competitors already that do phone interviews, like an AI that is doing the phone interviews. And the benefit of having the AI conduct the phone interviews, I don't think candidates really understand it yet, because they're going to get more opportunities to interview. Mm-hmm. They're going to be impacted by less bias that's inherent in every human being. They're going to be evaluated just on the basis of, do you have the skills to do the job? And it's going to rate you strictly on that, and not anything to do with your age, you know, where you're from, color of your skin, anything like that. So I think when people start to understand the benefit of letting AIs do the phone screen and the scoring of you as a candidate, when they understand the benefit of it, they're going to be a lot more open to it. But that, sadly, that's going to eliminate a lot of recruiter jobs. So yeah, we'll see how that goes. But the tool is awesome. The only thing that they need to tweak a little bit is on like 2 of the questions, there was about a 10-second delay where the AI wasn't saying anything. And I was like, okay, is it over?
Yeah, it was thinking.
Yeah, is it over? Did the AI just die? Like, is this interview still happening? Or what did I say, right? So I think they're fixing it. Maybe it had to do with the background noise in the room or something like mm-hmm. that. But so I'm worried about what AI is going to do to the recruiting game. But as a cybersecurity engineer, I feel like that's only a industry that's going to grow, because smarter AIs get, the more people you're going to need watching out for what the heck is doing.
Yep.
I feel like, yeah, you're in a safe bet there. But did you watch the podcast is Dwarkesh Patel. He interviewed an ex OpenAI developer, researcher, something like that. It's really interesting. It's 4.5 hours long, and they're just talking about just you gotta listen to it. I don't know if Dwarkesh is actually involved in building AI or if he's just running a podcast, but man, you know, they're talking about what the world's going to be like whenever Microsoft or Google, or they have a $1 trillion cluster that has unlimited capabilities. What are we going to do when there's a $1 trillion cluster other companies have to defend against? It's going to get nuts, man. What's your prediction for all that?
I don't even know. It's going to be mayhem if that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, hey, Leopold, the guy, I mean, he basically, there were some parts of the interview when he was like, hey, you know what? There's a lot of chaos coming. I just hope we survive it all. That's heartwarming right there. Yeah. You know, I'm not worried at all now. That makes me feel a lot better. Thanks, Leopold.
I think that's where regulations and all that stuff come in. So hopefully the guys who are setting the parameters and the rules behind the usage of AI are making good choices.
I hope so. Would you consider yourself an optimist or a pessimist when it comes to AI?
Definitely an optimist. Yeah, I would probably say I'm an optimist overall.
I'm trying to become one, but I'm not one. You've had a lot of success in your career. I'm sure a lot of folks that are early in their career or trying to get into cybersecurity will look at you like, wow, I mean, I just need to do what he did. So you got any advice for entry level folks who are trying to get into the industry?
Yeah, I have a few tips and tricks that they can do. One of the first things is, obviously, if you can afford it, if you can do it, I'd say get a formal education somewhere like WGU. It's very fast paced and you could just go through it. You don't need it though. I make an emphasis on getting an education because it is a small step in the door, where a bachelor's or an associate's or a master's degree, it gets you the interview. That's just the truth of the matter. The other things that can get you the interview are things like your CompTIA Security Plus and Network Plus. I don't really favor the A plus as much, because I feel like if you're interviewing for a tech position, you probably already have A plus knowledge. So Sec Plus, Net Plus are kind of a must. I remember when I was hiring back at ThreadLocker, it's one of the things we look for. You having your Sec Plus, your Net Plus, those are just certifications that are just solid. Just show that you have a pretty good foundation in cybersecurity. The other thing is projects. Depending on what you want to do, like, do you want to get into programming? Then, like, if you want to be a front-end developer, build a front-end app. If you want to be a full-stack developer, build an entire website out. If you want to, you know, be a red teamer, build a red teaming tool that people use, build a community, post it on Reddit, talk about it with other people. You want to be a blue teamer, then build a SOC, build a SIEM, and then just demonstrate it through a project. Oh, the other thing that's very important is sometimes people try to shoot for the moon from the start. I started out in the support role. And although not everybody has to go through it, it's a good start. Just starting off in help desk can get you just, you know, your foot in the door. And if you really have that experience, the people that are your company, if they're pretty good at seeing talent, they'll notice it and they'll say, hey, you're not meant to be here. We got to move you up somewhere else. So that's a really good thing. Sometimes we need to start in help desk. You need to humble yourself and just start at a lower role. And that's okay. That's some of the things a lot of us have to go through. Don't always apply for remote roles. Sadly, although cybersecurity and tech is really moving towards that remote, you know, work from home landscape, it's not always the case. And 9 times out of 10, you'll probably have a better chance of finding a job just somewhere locally. So just find startups, find companies that are local. They might be willing to take a chance on you because there's just not a huge pool of candidates that are in your area that have those skills. So definitely, maybe your first job just has to be, you know, on site. And I've been seeing it a lot with the newer guys that are coming into tech, especially cybersecurity. A lot of their jobs are moving to Texas, they're moving to Florida, I'm moving to California, and I keep seeing on-site, on-site, on-site. Maybe that's what you need to get that first role, is just go into an on-site role that's near you or in another state and just starting through that route. And obviously, like I said, post your work on LinkedIn, on whatever platform you may be. If you want to build a YouTube channel, you just want to, you know, a journey of how you started in cybersecurity. It's just like, it adds to your resume, because when somebody looks through your resume, it only says so much. But if you have a YouTube channel, if you have a GitHub page, if you have LinkedIn posts, then that just shows that you've been doing this for a long time. You've been dedicated, you've been consistent, and that work speaks, you know, it speaks numbers for what you can do for an organization. It's a clear indicator that you're going to be pretty good.
Great advice. Listen up, folks. Are you involved in any meetup groups, or did you go to conferences prior to the RSA?
Yeah, I've been to a couple of B-sides. I went to HackerspaceCon. I will continue to go to HackerspaceCon. That is one of my favorite conferences. I might be at Black Hat, depending on my availability. So I'll definitely go to some of those meetups. Beforehand, I wasn't going to much meetups other than just like your B-sides. But B-sides is a really good place to, you know, find people are looking for analysts and for other roles. So it's definitely a good place to start. B-sides is really good.
Agreed. Yeah, B-sides in North Carolina is coming up. Plan on going to that. But yeah, I mean, to your point, be open to on-site jobs. As a recruiter, I'm seeing a lot of positions that, you know, the ones we get and the ones that we don't get, but we're seeing advertised online. I mean, you're right. The lion's share of jobs now are going to be at least hybrid. So if you're entry level and you're only open to remote gigs, wow, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You got to be open to going on site, and it's going to benefit you as well to learn from your peers and just be around the space. You're going to learn much faster that way than just being cooped up in the house. Save that for when you're later in career and know exactly what you're doing. You know, when you can do your job with one arm tied behind your back and a blindfold on, then go be a remote.
I agree with you.
Employee. But yeah, help desk is a great place to get your foot in the door and to try to go above and beyond to succeed. Because when you're on the help desk, right, it's the speed of the tickets that you can handle and the resources that you can, you know, utilize to solve the problem without escalating it to tier two or three, right? And if you start to be the person that can answer all the questions on tier one, right, you're going to get a promotion to tier two. And then from there, you're going to either go into some kind of networking, systems engineering, cybersecurity. It's a launch pad. Yep. So definitely encourage folks to, you know, you might have to be in a support role, right? You might have to do help desk. You just might have, even though your ego won't like it, you might have to do it. So just do it.
Yep.
But good advice, man. Kudos to you.
More than anything, you just be looking for passion and looking for people who have just, you know, the grit. And like I said, I would do cybersecurity for free. So just looking for people that really love what they do, that aren't just doing it because, you know, they just got to get a paycheck at the end of the month. More people who are just doing it for fun, and then the paycheck just comes and surprises them.
Yeah, I hope that it's at some point companies decide to bring back more of like an apprenticeship style system to where it will help kind of shuttle in some of the, you know, they've got internships, but I feel like the internships isn't really the same because they, you know, the interns get lumped over here. They go over here and do this rookie project. And instead, like, assign one person to one senior engineer and let the, you know, let them work in tandem with each other. So they get to see some of the more mission critical stuff too, and not just the softball projects.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
I agree with you.
Are you a gamer at all?
Yeah, I play video games here and there. I used to play video games a lot when I was younger, kind of substituted cybersecurity for video games. Hack the Box is my new video game and for Hack Me or whatever. But I still play like the PlayStation 5. I have it behind my monitors here. Play with some friends sometimes. I really like playing 2K, the basketball game. And then I'll play Overwatch sometimes. I like those type of games. Any new game that comes out that seems fun, I'll play it for like a week or two. They get bored.
Yeah. Overwatch, that's the second time I've heard that game's pretty good. I've been on Fortnite, and I mean, I didn't even start playing Fortnite until, you know, I'm 40 years old. So, I mean, that game's been out forever, but now I'm like, man, cause I now I've met so many people that I'll sign in and then get a little headset going.
Yeah.
And I've met so many people playing Fortnite. It's really fun, man. I'm definitely into it. And the battle royale type of game, just like Overwatch, I'm assuming, right? They have, you know, you know, you start with 100 players and you're trying to, you know, win the death match.
Yeah.
It's just because you never know how it's going to play out, and it makes every little 20-minute game so fun. But what's the deal with Overwatch? Do they have – are they selling skins or
– Now they sadly are, but they used to just do loot boxes and you can get every single skin. This is back in the Overwatch 1 days. I've been playing since beta. So
okay.
I've been playing for quite – the game's been out since 2016, 2020, eight years now. So the game's been out for about 8 years. Overwatch 2 has now surpassed Overwatch 1. And it's more of like, have you played before League of Legends?
I've heard about it, but no.
Think about it like a team-based game where you have five players on one team. I believe it used to be six. Yeah, it used to be six. Now there's five players. There's a map. And then each player has like their own abilities. Each character has like abilities. It could be like a hammer, a shield. Some people can fly and shoot rockets. Some people are snipers. It's just more of a strategy-based game where you have to like either push a payload to a point or you have to capture a checkpoint. So you have different like attack scenarios and it's like a 5v5.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So are you playing in third person view or are you playing in like Overwatch, like World of Warcraft?
View? No, that's the cool part of it, because I don't like that overview third person. It's a first person shooter.
First person. Okay. Yeah. So it's like, have you played Defiant at all? The new one that just came out? I've heard good things about it. I'm scared to download it because I don't
want to. Have you played Battlefront 2? The Star Wars game?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I played Battlefront.
I love that game.
Yeah. I like it too. There's, you know, I guess they just kind of abandoned the game. They're not supporting it anymore, and that kind of sucks. But yeah, they could have kept that going into infinity, man. They could have turned that into another Fortnite. But now instead, Disney invested $1.5 billion in Epic Games out here, and they're in my backyard, right? They're in Cary. I guess they're not doing that. They're just going to invest in Fortnite, and now they get access to Unreal Engine for their movies and stuff like that. Are you watching Acolyte?
I just finished episode one before this podcast.
Did you really? Oh, tell anybody. In between onboarding videos, right?
I was in my lunch break.
I hear it. So you've seen the first episode, but not the second.
Not the second. And so far, I don't like it already.
But yeah. I mean,
I don't know how you feel about it.
Man, so the first time I watched it, I think it's like the newness and like you don't know where the story's going to go and everything's kind of exciting. So you just watch it and it's kind of like you're easily entertained. And some of the stuff sneaks by you, right? But I watched it for a second time and that was after watching some of the YouTube, like analysis, some of the comments. Yeah, Star Wars Theory. I definitely like Star Wars Theory. Yeah, he's great. Theory, you're invited on the podcast, man. Let's talk sometime. I'll buy a saber if you actually, you know what? You have to give me a free saber to come on the podcast. So yeah, listen to him. Whatever you do, don't listen to Robot Head. He'll ruin every Star Wars show except for the originals for you.
Got you.
Okay. You'll be watching his analysis and his commentary, and he'll point out stuff that you didn't realize and be like, God, I hate that he's right. But he's right. you watch stuff like that. And then when you watch it for a second time, you see all these things that don't make any sense, right? Fire and space. Star Wars has never been.
That's what I was literally, you just made a point that I was so confused while I was watching. I was like, how is there fire, space? There's no oxygen. I was like, I'll just, whatever. That's what I didn't like. It feels like there wasn't enough investment into just, it wasn't well thought out. And then just some of the lines are just corny.
Yeah, it's just like there's so many things like that watching it for a second time. It's just like, man.
It wasn't Dave Filoni who wrote this, was it?
No, it was Leslie Headland.
Clear as day that it
wasn't. Yeah. And she's not a Star Wars fan. We'll see where it goes, man. As a Star Wars fan, it's not like I'm not going to watch.
Exactly. They take advantage of us, you see, because we love anything they shoot at us, so we're going to watch it anyway. Like, I have no Netflix. I have no Hulu. Like, I only have Disney Plus because of Star Wars. So it's kind of sad that they're using us this way, but
it is, but I don't know, man. Recently, like I had a Star Wars sign right there in my background. And I recently it's obvious that my background's Star Wars, but I'm at least not putting their logo back here. I mean, at least you can't see the logo. Yeah. I don't know if that changes anything, but we'll see, man. I'm looking forward to anything that people that did Rogue One and the people that made Andor, Tony Gilroy, can't wait for that.
Rogue One is my favorite movie after the classics.
For sure. Rogue One is my favorite, but Andor, man, it's on a whole nother level than anything else that Star Wars has ever done. Mm-hmm. And it's all because of the Gilroy brothers. I mean, they had a lot of time to tinker with the script and rewrite it, but anything they touch has just a much deeper storyline to it. So can't wait for Andor 2. And I want to see, a lot of people hate on the Solo movie.
I liked it. It was okay.
Yeah, I liked it fine. But Kira, where's Kira?
Exactly.
Where'd she go, man?
Exactly.
I want a movie about Kira.
Yep.
What's your theory? Where'd she go? Because she was on a mission to go see Darth Maul, I think. Remember? Oh,
yeah. That'd be actually an interesting movie if we had a Darth Maul movie with Kira. Yeah. And then it was just Darth Maul just rebuilding, you know, his legs.
Instead, what do they do? Now they're going to go back to 200 years before Phantom Menace and try to tell that story. Or yep. What, 120 years? The decisions that are getting made right now. I'm upset. But, hey, man, I appreciate you coming on. I'm going to let you get back to your day. And I can't wait to see where your career goes, man. You're going to crush it over there.
Thank you, Blake. It's been great.
Yeah, man. My pleasure. You've been awesome.
Thank you, sir. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too, my man. Take care.
Take care.